Many of you will have heard me preach, or to be fair, sometimes get a bit ranty, about the toxicity of what is called purity culture. That aspect of patriarchy that is obsessed with how women look, particularly regarding dressing modestly, no sex outside of marriage, and basically telling women that moral purity is their responsibility. Yes, it affects men too, but the usual double standard is that it's really up to the woman to enforce this moral and particularly sexual purity, and it's women that are blamed when men fail. And that there is more complexity to it, but this obsession with moral purity is really what has shaped much of contemporary evangelical Christianity and continues to affect much of the world. To the point that many people think of Christianity as no more than a system of restrictive morality wrapped up with an obsession for heaven. And of course, sending anyone who disagrees to the other place. But what do we say about hell, Pam?
There is no hell.
We don't believe it exists, at least not on the other side of death. Jean-Paul Sartre once said, "Hell is other people," but I wouldn't go that far. Now, though I don't normally do this with our readings for the day, I do think that they all have something in common. There is a thread for the three of them, and it's actually that they all have something to say about purity. But the purity they point to is a purity of intention. They're concerned with the motivation behind what we do. From the reasons for feasting and fasting in Isaiah, to Paul's longing for the church to be absolutely dedicated to Christ, to Jesus talking of the effect that we have on the world, and absolute adherence to the law of love, the law of God. There is an admirable mix of complexity and simplicity in today's scriptural offerings. Jesus, being the sublime storyteller that he is and user of images, shares those memorable images of salt and light. Everyday items that have great effect, great value. Salt with its preservative and flavoring qualities, light with its transformative nature. Paul, whilst wandering around in philosophy, delves into what some authors, some commentators have said, is an ironic statement. Among the mature, we do speak wisdom, though it's not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age. At Sermon Circle, our Bible discussion on Wednesday morning, I said I thought that this passage from 1 Corinthians felt somewhat smug, pretty much saying, well, we get the message, but many don't because they're not as spiritual as us. Having read a little more around the passage and about the passage, it seems that rather than putting anyone down, Paul is instead using hyperbole to express his concern that the Corinthians fully enter into the life of Christ, the fullness of life, that they may not merely know about that fullness, but may know it. May know the truly transformative nature of being, to use a phrase from elsewhere in Paul's writings, being in Christ. That's what he means about being in the Spirit to such a degree that we understand the depth of the Spirit, that we have a pure understanding of it. As a slight aside, but not an aside, I'm intrigued by the mention of God's wisdom being not one comprehended by the wisdom of this age or by the rulers of this age, particularly as we see in our neighbors to the south actively hijacked Christianity and even have the U.S. Speaker of the House using Romans chapter 13 badly out of context and with terrible exposition in an attempt to school the Pope as to why racism and terror by government are acceptable. We have an orange calf that millions of those who call themselves Christians worship in order that they might have a power to create their own nation of what they believe to be moral and racial purity. The wisdom of Christ is indeed not understood by the rulers of this age. It's a wisdom of relationship, of service, of grace, of love, of inclusion, of affirmation, of justice, and of peace. Instead, we have so-called Christian nationalism, not just in the States, but throughout the world, which one commentator described as white supremacy dressed up in Bible drag. In today's gospel reading, Jesus' reflection on the values that his followers should hold is almost too simple. These images that relate to everyday life and perhaps are so familiar to us in our world of convenience that we lose the power of salt and light. They are salt and light for us so easily obtained. And yet, those who heard it first would hear those vivid images of things that people really needed that changed their lives. Perhaps we should ask ourselves that as the people of God, are we, in a world filled with convenience, just another condiment? Or are we this wonderful, life-affirming, inclusive and faithful, prayerful, struggling, loving and serving community? Are we essential to the world around? I believe we are. You've heard me say before that I think one of the great disservices that we as a church have done to the message of faith is to individualize it to the nth degree, to make it exclusively about oneself, almost like a kind of divine self-help manual. That's a common theme that I pick up from many of the books, and indeed the messages from so many churches that I read, whether it's an obsession with my own individual sin and salvation, or whether it's all about being about my relationship with Jesus, or that woefully unchristian phrase, my religion is a personal thing. So many contemporary thoughts about faith seem to be nothing more than, as Depeche Mode and the late great Johnny Cash once sang, my own personal Jesus. Faith, we believe, is about a greater reality, about a call to purity of action and of thought, a purity of grace and intention, about a common calling to love and to grace, an acceptance and love, and hope and love. And did I mention love? When I mention our calling to be people of faith and service and integrity, I mean it in the plural. It's hard to do this faith thing by ourselves. And when Paul writes to the various communities where the Jesus movement is just beginning, and when Jesus addresses the crowds, it is to communities that those words are given. Or as the Orthodox Church says, we are saved together, we fall apart. In the end, of course, you and I are special, precious, and absolutely loved. The Christian witness is that God considers each one of us to have value beyond price. And just to say that is to lose out on the riches of our calling to be a righteous people. And by righteous, the Bible means just, working towards that integrity and wholeness that is the kingdom of shalom. If we just concern ourselves with our own individual journey, then we lose out on that calling to be a righteous people, a body knit together in Christ. So we are seeking to find out together what being God's people is, with each one of us having a place within that. And I don't pretend to have all the answers. In fact, a sermon like this does little more than set out what Jesus set out to do with these images in the first place, to ask questions of where we are and where we're going. So the question remains, is how you and I and we as Christ Church can be salt and light in this place and at this time. I know many ways in which this church fellowship makes positive contributions to our local community. I know something of the light that is already shed by members of this congregation and by the church itself as it reaches out and it welcomes in the name of Christ. But, or and, we must always consider the impact if any, we are having on the world around us. For of course, essentially the purpose of both salt and light is to make a difference. And in our faith as individuals and as a church, if we're not making a difference, what should we be doing about it? Thanks be to God.